It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pittsburgh is a town that has had much to celebrate in sports. The Immaculate Reception, 6 Super Bowl championships, 3 Stanley Cups, national college football titles, and those 5 World Series wins by the Pirates. And yet, one moment stands out above all others. The Pirates' 1960 World Series victory over the great New York Yankees, decided, of course, by Bill Mazeroski's dramatic home run in the bottom of the 9th inning of Game 7, the only time it's happened in baseball history.
Here's a swing and a high fly ball going deep left. That may do it. Back to the wall goes Barra. It is home run. The Pirates win. It's the 1960 World Champions defeat the New York Yankees. The Pirates 10 and the Yankees 9.
And that, of course, the voice of the immortal Chuck Thompson. There is an exhibit this month at the Heinz History Center featuring artifacts from that historic World Series, including the bat Bill Mazeroski used to hit the winning home run and uniforms from Maz and his partner in the middle infield, all-star shortstop Dick Grote, who played a huge part in the success of that season as captain of the team, as well as batting champion and most valuable player of the National League. And we're honored to have him in Studio A with us now to talk about the exhibit and the 1960 season, among other things. Dick Grote, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. I'm very happy to be here.
There had been years of futility for the Pirates leading up to 1960, but were there things that indicated to you that the Pirates were heading for big things in 1960?
Well, believe it or not, Paul, in those days, you had a chance to build a baseball team with the same players over because the reserve clause was still in existence. Free agency was not there. So when we started, we were a very, very bad baseball team under Mr. Rickey, but he basically put it together, a draft here when he drafts Elroy Face, and then he drafts Bobby Clemente, and he signed Bob Skinner, he signed Bob Friend, he signed Bill Mazeroski, and we all had a chance to mature together, and we were so bad, and I've talked very, very much about the Pirates of today being very similar to the Pirates back then. We were in last place in 1958, the end of July, and all of a sudden learned how to win. You don't know why it happens or when it happens, but all of a sudden we all grew up together as Law and Friend and Face became better pitchers. Verdon and Clemente became better outfielders. Mazeroski and I became better infielders. And it all evolved around growing up together. And that's exactly what's happening with the Pirate organization right now. They came alive last year. You don't know after 20 years why all of a sudden they learn how to win. But they certainly did a great job. And it was great for the city last year, Paul.
Oh, it certainly was. And in 1960, there hadn't been the successful Steeler teams, and obviously the Immaculate Reception hadn't happened yet. The Penguins weren't even in existence, and the Pirates had 35 very mediocre seasons since their, with the exception of 1927, since their last World Championship in 1925. So describe what it was like for the city of Pittsburgh to suddenly have something, anything, to be excited about in sports.
Well, it started in 1958, as I mentioned. The end of July, we were in last place, tied for last place, and came out of nowhere to absolutely fight Milwaukee for the pennant. They went on and won the World Championship in 57 and lost to the Yankees in 58. But the basic ball club had been put together by this time. Joe Brown made the trade for Burgess, Haddix, and Hoke, which made a tremendous difference, balanced our club out completely. We finished fourth in 59. But all of a sudden in 60, we were a team of destiny, which you've heard many, many times or read, that people called us a team of destiny. we didn't think we were ever supposed to lose, even against the fantastic Yankee ball club, which was a great baseball team.
Did it mean more to beat them, to beat the Yankees? I mean, this was a team that had Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle and these great hitters. Did it mean more to beat a team like that in the World Series?
It always does. In fact, I was very fortunate having never wanted to leave Pittsburgh, but this is my hometown. When Joe Brown traded me to the Cardinals, I was fortunate enough to defeat the Yankees again in 1964, which is our 50-year reunion this year. But beating the Yankees, it was a great organization, well-run, well-disciplined. They absolutely dominated the American League.
You said that I heard a comment from you where you said that in 64, even though you got to be a part of another team that won a World Series, that it broke your heart to be traded from the Pirates to St. Louis. And you mentioned you were a Pittsburgh boy. You grew up in Wilkinsburg, and you still make your home in the area. What was that like to go through that?
It was the most miserable winter I can ever remember during my baseball career, having been traded. I had no desire to ever leave the city of Pittsburgh. And I grew up in Swissville, not Wilkinsburg. I was born in Wilkinsburg, but I've been born and reared in Swissville and never wanted to be traded. But again, sometimes the grass can be greener on the other side of the street, because the Cardinal organization treated me extremely well the 3 years I wore a Cardinal uniform.
Now, going back to 1960, what was it like to play in the middle infield with Bill Mazeroski? Describe the chemistry that you had with him as a double play partner.
Well, first of all, Bill came up in 1956. I was a rookie in 52, went in the Army in 3 and 4, came back in 55, so I had a year experience, 2 years experience, basically in the big leagues when Bill came up. And I played with, I think I counted it up one day, in the 2.5 years I played before that, I had 12 different second basemen. Mazeroski walked on the diamond, and it was a whole different world. He was just magnificent. From the first day he set foot on a major league diamond, nobody ever played second base like Bill Mazeroski. It was just a pleasure and a joy to go to the ballpark every day with Bill.
What made him so good?
He just had great, first of all, he had great legs, a lot stronger than people realize, great feet, and had great baseball instincts. He never forgot when you told him you wanted him to play one position that way. You never had to tell him the second time. He remembered every move, and he just did things better than anybody I've ever seen at second base. The way he released the ball, the way he turned the double play. In fact, Bill and I talked about this in my golf course here a year or so ago. I can't ever remember him ever giving me a throw where I was going to get buried at second base with a base runner. He always gave me the ball where I could handle it and get rid of it and stay alive.
And what you're describing is the peril that a middle infielder, particularly a shortstop like yourself, goes through on a ground ball hit to the right side of the infield, and with a double play in play, you're coming over second base, taking a throw and trying to make another throw to first base as the runner is barreling into you, and you have to try to somehow sidestep him and stay on your feet. And if the ball's in a bad spot, you're going to be in a collision, aren't you? You're going to be in harm's way.
No doubt about it, but not with Mazeroski. I don't think Billy ever gave me a bad throw at second base. He was just that perfect.
Now, Maz is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, deservedly so. You were an All-Star as well as a batting champion and an MVP. Do you ever ask yourself, why aren't I in Cooperstown?
Because I wasn't a superstar. I was not a Clemente. I was not a Mazeroski. Those guys were a step and a half, maybe 2 steps to 5 steps above us. They were just that special.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is former Pirates great Dick Groat. You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. 646-2002. The email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH, and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What questions do you have or stories would you like to hear from Dick Grote? Call us at 412-246-2002. Dick, what do you think of the exhibit at the Heinz? When you look at the memorabilia there, including your old uniform, what kind of memories and thoughts does it bring back?
Well, just there's no way you can redo or relive the special moments of being in a World Series in your hometown to start with, much less beating, as we mentioned earlier, the New York Yankees, the premier team in all of baseball. It's something I had never had seen a winner in my lifetime in Pittsburgh, and now all of a sudden I'm part of the first world championship in Pittsburgh's baseball history in 35 years. It's just, it was just a dream come true.
And as that was happening, and that really drives the point home, when you say that you had never experienced a winner, you're growing up in this area and the Pirates were always bad. Now, here they've become not only a good team, but you're a part of the team. And the fans who've waited for the team to become good, what was it like for them? But of course, by the World Series, you've got sellout crowds and everybody's going crazy. But what was the buildup to that like in 1960?
Well, even now you hear people talk about, if you live through that period, you could walk down any street in Pittsburgh at night and there'd be the Bob Prince just blaring off in the radio. Everybody had the baseball game on because it just, as the momentum built, this team had so much charm about it, coming from behind as many times as we did from the seventh inning on. I can remember Danny Murtaugh actually in a meeting facetiously saying, one of these days I'm just going to stay home and come down and watch the game from the seventh inning on because you guys are driving me crazy.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to join the conversation with Dick Grote. Let's go to Jerry in Homestead. Jerry, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, my question to Mr. Grote is, there was a young fellow as a pinch hitter. They put him in the inning before. His name was Powers, and he cleared the bases and allowed Mazeroski the following inning to win that game. But how come they forgot about Powers?
You've lost me. I can't remember this name at all.
Are you talking about Hal Smith?
Well, he was a pinch hitter. I remember his name was Paul.
Okay.
We were listening to that down in the mill because we were working on a labor gang at the time.
No, Paul, it was Hal Smith, and he was actually catching at the time because they had taken Smokey out for a base runner. And when Hal Smith hit the home run, he was actually in the lineup and catching at that time.
I thought his name was Powers, that they put in for a pinch hitter, you know, at the time. Maybe they haven't corrected it, but I'm not.
We've always said that was the biggest forgotten home run in the history of baseball.
We went wild, Don, and we were in a labor gang. Everybody was listening to it, and we went wild. And then Mazeroski got up to the next inning, it was tied up and hit the home run, and everybody went nuts, you know.
I think we've cleared it up now for you. It was Hal Smith. He came in. He gave the Pirates. He hit a home run that gave the Pirates a 9-7 lead.
Yeah. But the thing
three-run homer.
Somebody better check it. You know, that young man should remember, too, because whoever it was, you know, there was something happened there before Mazeroski got up there to get the home run to win the game.
Well, you know, Jerry, he would have, but then the Yankees tied the game in the top of the ninth. They got those two runs. And, Dick, when the Yankees, you know, here after the home run by Smith, Forbes Field was going about as crazy as it was when Mazeroski eventually hit his home run. And you had to be thinking, okay, got to get three more outs and we're the champs. And what was it like to have the Yankees come back? You had to be heartsick.
We were. There was no doubt about it because I can remember going out to shortstop thinking, three outs and we're the world champions. And Bobby Richardson hit a line drive base hit. Dale Long pinch hit. Hit a line drive to right field, and all of a sudden, the tying runs are on base, and the Yankees didn't leave those kind of runs on base very often.
Where were you when Maz hit the home run?
I was in the dugout. I had just walked down to get my helmet and my bat because I was a fourth hitter in the inning. And in the dugout in those days, you're almost ground level looking, and I can still hear everybody in the dugout yelling, "Get off the wall, get off the wall." None of us realized, and if you see Mazeroski on that film over and over again, he's running as hard as he can run. When he made the turn and the umpire put his hand up, there was a home run. He was going to get that extra base, maybe a double, maybe even a triple off the wall.
Who knows? If that had happened, you might have been the guy that got the sacrifice fly or the base hit that then drove him in.
You never know.
We're talking with Dick Grote, who was a great two-sport athlete in college at Duke. He was a basketball and baseball player. After you graduated, you played for a while in two major professional sports leagues, the NBA and Major League Baseball. How were you able to, I mean, I think you were one of the only, if not the only, athlete to do that. How did you balance those schedules? Because they overlapped.
Well, it was strange because I knew I had been drafted. I had played the summer of 1952 with Ralph Kiner and the Pirates at that time, and I was going back to Duke to finish up on my diploma. I was only carrying 9 credits, so that meant I went to class on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I knew I was drafted, but I knew in Durham, North Carolina, I couldn't play for a team in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is where the Pistons were located. Well, they flew me out there on a couple weekends, and I ended up signing a contract and played just on Saturdays and Sundays and then flew back. And then finally I got grounded in Detroit one night. And back in those days, something that's kind of non-existent today, at Duke, if you cut your class 3 times, the 4th time you cut yourself out of school. Well, after getting grounded, I had cut 1 time to finish the season with the Pirates. The 2nd time I got grounded, and all I can think of is if I don't graduate when my grades are good right now, and they were very good, my father would have killed me. So I had to call the Pistons and say I quit. So I only played, let's say, 4 to 6 games. About a week later, I get another phone call. They called me back and said, "We have to have you back. We've decided we have things solved for you." I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "We got you a private plane that will fly you from Durham, North Carolina to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and get you back for that 8:10 class on Monday morning."
They hired a plane just for you.
And I said to myself, "I don't know." And being a 21-year-old young man at that time, free and single, they said, "And we'll double your salary." Maybe I can handle that after all. So instead of just playing on the weekends now, I would play on Monday, I go to class on Monday, fly to New York on Tuesday, play against the Knicks, fly home, go to class on Wednesday, fly to Philadelphia, fly back. And I never had more fun in my life. I never had to practice. And just had a great time playing in the NBA.
You were a jet setter before there was such a term. And imagine the idea of a school making an athlete actually go to class. It's unheard of. Doug in Stallstown is on the phone for us. Doug, welcome to Central Pittsburgh. You're on with Dick Grote.
Very good. First, I want to say I specifically remember that game, the number 7 game. I was 12 years old in 7th grade in junior high school, and our whole school had gone to the auditorium for that game. And the magic of that moment lives on like it happened yesterday. It was so powerful. And one question I have is, I was told that Bill Mazeroski lives in a simple home in North Huntington, PA, on Walton T-Room Road. Is this correct?
He lives not in North Huntington, no. He lives in Greensburg or Hempfield Township. He still lives there, he and Mylene. They have a place in Florida in the winter, and then he is in spring training with the Pirates and does the fantasy camp, but he still lives in the home he lived when he was playing with the Pirates.
That's a great question. Thank you, Doug. And, yeah, athletes didn't make the kind of money then that they do now. How much would you be worth today, Dick Groat?
It's a little bit scary when you think about it, because I think I'm not telling any secrets. When that 60 team, I was making $18,000. I think Bill was making $14,000 or $16,000.
$18,000 was your salary on a world championship major league team.
That's correct.
Wow. You were, as we were discussing earlier, a great two-sport athlete in college at Duke, and ultimately you ended up choosing baseball over basketball, even though you had, you know, an NBA team that was falling all over themselves to try to make sure you could get from your campus to the games. How did you end up choosing baseball over basketball instead of, you know, trying to play both? What ultimately made you decide, I'm going to stick with baseball and baseball only?
Well, I really wanted to play both sports. I especially wanted to play basketball because I felt I was a much better basketball player for at least a couple years. But when I had my contract after I came out of the service, I went right to spring training with the Pirates in 1955, and the Pistons met me in Philadelphia with a contract, so I was all set. And I remember saying vividly, I'll be very happy. I'm happy with the terms. I was making more money than baseball or basketball than I was in baseball. I said, I'll be glad to sign this contract, but I won't sign it until I get the okay from Mr. Rickey. I had signed a 5-year bonus contract in 1952, and that carried over. This is now 55, so I still had another year or two on that bonus contract. And Mr. Rickey had no sense of humor about my playing both sports. And I'm not sure he was probably right. I right away said, well, Gene Conley does it. He said, that's not a fair comparison. Gene Conley's a pitcher that goes every fifth day. Gene Conley's a backup center to Bill Russell. You're a starting shortstop and a starting point guard. The human body can't take that punishment. And eventually you won't justify your money with either team. I can't argue now, looking back on it at my age, that he was probably right.
Branch Rickey, certainly a wise baseball man, the man who helped break the color line in baseball. He signed Jackie Robinson when he was with the Brooklyn Dodgers back in 1947. Something about your career, Dick Groat, that I wanted to point out, and you mentioned it, military service. It doesn't happen today, but years ago, I can remember it happening growing up with players like Richie Hebner on the Pirates. They would disappear, you know, sometimes in the middle of the season and have to fulfill military obligations. You did this early in your career, went off to fulfill your obligation to perform duty as part of the U.S. Armed Forces. How much did that throw things off for you when you had to return to the lineup and try to pick up where you left off in the middle of the season?
It's a little bit difficult, but again, that was the way things were set up at that period of time. Everyone went into service for 2 years, and I was fortunate enough that I did not have to leave the United States, spent 2 years in the service. Played service baseball, not the competition you would get in the major leagues. So I think it hurt me to be away from the game, the major league caliber game, for 2 years. But again, that was part of life. We just accepted that because everybody went into service back in those days.
Now, today you are still working very hard as the color analyst on Pitt basketball games. You've been doing this with Bill Hillgrove for 35 years. You are, if you don't mind me mentioning, 83 years old. How long will you keep doing this?
As long as I can still do the job. Working with Bill Hillgrove is an absolute privilege and a joy. He is the ultimate professional. And it's been, I love college basketball. It's always been my first love. Broadcasting Jamie Dixon's teams has been a joy. He's done an excellent job. You know, it's not every year, every college that has 26 wins every season. And it's been a real joy the last 11 years when Jamie Dixon has been the head coach at Pitt.
Have you found that a whole new generation of Pittsburghers, Pittsburgh sports fans, have learned about you as a result of your involvement with Pitt?
No doubt about it. It's a completely different thing, because I think it's a fact of life. Most places, you're kind of overlooked when you're a hometown boy. Don't ask me why, but it's been that way. I know how I've been received in St. Louis when I go back there, which, as I mentioned earlier, this is our 50-year reunion of the World Championship St. Louis Cardinal Club in 1964. For some reason, being a hometown boy is pretty special. For me, it was anyway. But you're kind of overlooked in a lot of ways.
And now are there people that say, oh, yeah, he's the broadcaster. Yeah,
That's true.
They only know you as the broadcaster. They might not know the background.
That's very, very true.
Have you ever had a reaction where somebody was just blown away when they found out, oh, yeah, and by the way, he was the National League Most Valuable Player and he was on the 1960 Pirates?
Sometimes, yes, that's correct, especially the younger generation. They don't have any idea. For example, I know when I was recognized at Peterson Event Center this year at the Duke Pitt game, I'm sure those basketball players had no idea who I was, even though my jersey's been hanging in Cameron for a long, long time.
That's right. They were the first. Your number was the first one retired by Duke in basketball, which is saying a lot with all that program's accomplished. And you've certainly accomplished a lot. It's been a pleasure talking to you about all of your different career highlights. Dick Groat, who was part of the 1960 World Champion Pirates team, which is being remembered as part of an exhibit at the Heinz History Center. And that exhibit continues through May 1st. You'll want to get down there and check it out. In the meantime, Dick Groat, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you here in our studio. Thank you so much for coming in and visiting us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. I've enjoyed it very, very much. As you know, I love Pittsburgh. The city has just been everything to all of us that grew up here.
Coming up, travel correspondent Elaine LaBalme takes us to Nashville. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.